Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Consider This. Please let me know what you think and tell others about us on social media. This podcast was originally broadcast live on Northumberland 89.7 FM. You can hear this show live every Friday at noon. Thank you for downloading this program, and I hope you enjoy it. Hello and welcome back. This is Consider This Northumberland, and I'm your host, Robert Washburn, and you're listening to Northumberland 89.7 FM. For those who face barriers finding a home, Transition House is an emergency shelter in Coburg where they can find a place to sleep, get a decent meal, and hopefully begin a journey back from the many difficulties they face. When the pandemic hit, the shelter was not well suited to provide the necessary protections for its clients. Through a collaboration of many people, a closed high school in Coburg, CCI, was opened as a temporary location. But with the fall quickly approaching and public schools reopening, clients and staff will return to the old Chapel Street building. Ann Newman, Executive Director of Transition House, spoke with me about the move back and the results of the organization's recent annual general meeting. Here is our phone conversation. I'm so pleased to have with me today Ann Newman, the Executive Director of Transition House. Welcome to Consider This.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you very much. Let's begin. Transition House Board of Directors held their annual general meeting recently. It has been a year of incredible changes, placing a lot of stresses on the shelter. Can you give us a snapshot of what is currently happening with Transition House?
Well, there is pre-COVID and post-COVID, so I'll talk about Transition House in COVID right now. So towards the end of March, we relocated into Coburg Collegiate Institute in order to be able to support social distancing and sanitation requirements, as the house wasn't really set up for that at that time. In that time, we have been able to update the facility to accommodate the sanitizing requirements, as well as determined how to best accommodate social distancing in that environment. And we will be relocating back to our original address on Chapel Street by August. So that's what's going on now. It is quite consuming at this time because COVID in itself has brought forth many different changes in regular service provision, right? So most of the services that we would connect our clients to aren't necessarily available to them right now. People are living in a dormitory type setting, which is causing further displacement, and maybe aggravating other types of mental health or addiction issues. So that's our focus lately.
So there's a couple of things in there that I'd like to just tease out a bit. I mean, the first one being you said you'd be going back in August. Do you have a date in August? Is it like at the end of the month, the 1st of August, or is it August 30th? And
yes.
You talked about changes to the house on Chapel Street. Can you tell us a bit more in detail what changes have you done? You talked about them generally, but can you be more specific?
Sure. So we've replaced the furniture, for example, so there'll be no couch sitting possibilities. So couches have been replaced with single cedar chairs that are appropriately social distanced. All of the house has been repainted and finished with products that are easily cleaned. And that includes, you know, we did have some older type rooms that had, you know, wood paneled siding on the wall. So we've removed those and re-drywalled the walls, etc., because wood absorbs bacteria a little better. We have installed all touch-free sanitizers, soaps, and towel dispensers so that we can avoid touching surfaces as much as possible. We've put new practices in place for staff and clients with PPEs and schedules in place to make sure that all that cleaning has been done to a gold standard.
Sounds expensive. How much did it cost?
Well, we received a grant for about $44,000 to be able to do this, and that came from Reaching Home through the Simcoe United Way. And we also received some funds through Cameco. That was $5,000. We received money from the W. Garfield Foundation to support that of $20,000. So we haven't spent all that money, but that's what we've received in to refresh.
Talk a bit more about the situation at CCI. You mentioned a few things that are going on there. Tell us a bit more about the services that you're providing and how it's working out.
So normally, when we would have been at the house, we would have a daily routine where people would get up, do chores, and then go on to their daily practices, which we connected them to, whether it was meeting with an ACT worker, or it was meeting with a social worker, or your housing worker, or going out to view apartments, whatever that schedule was. But we had something going on where people were not in the house during the day, and there was an expectation for production. Whereas now, and there was also privacy, so if someone wasn't feeling well, they could go to their room, they could have some of that privacy. Now we're in one room with 30 cots. There's no privacy at all, and there's really no services or nothing for people to do. So they are stuck in that environment almost 24 hours a day, you know? So the challenge becomes, okay, that's now your home. That's where you are 24 hours a day. But when they sit outside, it can be viewed as, you know, a gathering or cause stress for onlookers with people sitting so close together, or maybe they're smoking on school property, which is illegal. You know, that kind of issue comes out of that. But there's really nowhere for them to go during the day, other than, you know, to go to the amenities within Coburg that they're discouraged from going to. So that's difficult. I mean, we have other service providers that their staff are working from home now and would like to connect with clients by phone or video, et cetera, but our clients don't have that technology, and we don't have the staff or extra technology to facilitate that for them. So then it becomes all of those things are what our staff are doing. So I would say our staff are really, really burning out because they're really got a lot of extra service needs, immediate service needs that they really can't call on many other people for.
So what's the solution then?
Well, keep going. I mean, it's a pandemic. We just have to respond to whatever is in front of us. And right now we have COVID and we have, you know, the closure or the pausing of all these things. And as the world reopens and we can start engaging things again, I guess we get back to business as usual. In the meantime, we work to keep people as safe as possible, both the staff and the clients.
Now, you just held your annual general meeting, and as part of that, there was a presentation about a strategic plan that's going to take you from now until 2025. I'm wondering if you could just, for the listeners, give us maybe a top-line summary of what that strategic plan includes.
Well, first of all, we kind of got pushed back just a little bit because of COVID, because now we're in July, and we're just looking at rolling it out right now. So I think the next thing in order would be to operationalize this plan, and that's what we're looking at right now. But moving forward, we have five strategic directions that we are going to be focusing all our work on. And those, I'm just pulling them up now, those are ensuring high quality, responsive service delivery, fostering a healthy workplace culture, enhancing organizational stability and impact, engaging our community and partners, and strengthening organizational governance. So the next job is to take the work we're doing and align it to those goals and then create a plan to implement them over the next 5 years. I actually feel really excited about them because I think they are quite achievable.
In your optimism, what would be the ideal that you're aiming for? Because I know there's been a lot of changes. And for the community, we look at Transition House, and for, 17 years or more, it was this place where people came and they stayed for a very short period of time. They were looking for housing, and it was a temporary place where you were housed and you moved on, and that was it. And then since its reincarnation, since its reopening, it has become an emergency shelter. And I think for a lot of people, that means different things. So can you help us better understand when you talk about your strategic plan, what vision do you have?
Well, I think there, first of all, understanding what an emergency shelter is and understanding what a low barrier emergency shelter is. So our goal is to provide shelter for those in need who are at a position of requiring a place to stay, a meal, a shower, etc. Our goal is to connect people to the other services that will lead them to the next part of their journey, whether it's employment, education, housing, whatever, childcare, whatever the supports are that are needed, we will connect you to, you know, legal services or social work, etc. Low barrier, which I think is a difficult concept for some, is the fact that we will not say you can't come if you're intoxicated. So we will not only allow you to arrive intoxicated, but we will actually store legal substances for you. So if you want to have a beer, we'll store it for you in a safe place that we will control access to. We will not allow any illegal substances at all. But, for example, if somebody is struggling with addiction, we aren't going to require that they have that managed before we help them. So that is a difficult piece for some, but that's part of our philosophy. And then moving forward, I would love to see services expand to include different options to move them to the next stage. Because in emergency housing, if you move on to your own apartment, I have no longer have a relationship with you. And I think that connection, that follow-up connection, and that support once housed, to continue that, is important, and we can't provide it. So, and I do think it's maybe a little piece of the system that's missing, that follow-up piece. And I do think that the system itself, anywhere I've seen, never really accommodates for people's social needs, you know? So a lot of the time, loneliness is what might pull you out of your success in any of those areas. So to have those connections, I think, is really important, but it's missing. Now, in COVID, we did get access to funding opportunities, which caused growth, which is proposed to end in March. So I don't know what that will look like. But in COVID, we've received extra staffing for outreach work in the evening. And we are in the process of looking into creative ways to offer transitional housing through other environments, such as motel. So if we are moving into the house and we cannot accommodate all, we're trying to determine how can we creatively use this money to get you into a situation where we may be able to springboard you right into permanent housing. So those are things that we're looking at, and I really hope it does. I mean, in my vision, turn into a transitional housing program, because I think it's needed and it's necessary. But right now, you know, if it weren't for COVID, we wouldn't even be able to consider this option. So there's not a lot of money in this industry, typically, to be able to offer all of those creative options.
I know sometimes there are criticisms about the fact that there are no programs that Transition House offers, in terms of not just in terms of getting them services, but also things to keep them active through the day and engaging them on a different level. What about that piece in this puzzle? Because as the strategic plan goes forward, you know, you're talking about delivery, you're talking about a workplace culture, organizational issues, and then you have a piece about communities and partners. But is there sufficient services within the community that you can either partner with or that you could offer that would engage these people in a different way than other than just being a place where they can come and stay, and, as you said, get a meal, have a shower, have a place to sleep?
Well, we are committed to engaging with those services, providing access to transportation to get to those services, or even providing space for them to come in and host. But we cannot be those services. So, for example, there's a program called RentSmart, and that's managed through the county. And that is a sort of, it's a little bit of a workshop-based course that clients are to attend, and it's mandatory that they attend. And that is explaining and learning about how to understand the housing market, how to go through interviews with landlords, all this kind of stuff. So there's programs like that where we'll partner and we will run it, you know, every quarter for the clients, and they will have to attend to stay. We might partner with Watton Employment Services and have them attend programs over at their location. But we just need to be careful not to be those services, because then it becomes a duplication and it becomes inefficient. And I see it more as that. We're the hub to connect you, but we are not the service, because we only have someone for 90 days and we have such an influx of in and out that there's no way we could possibly manage that as well with the staffing that we have.
And then what happens after 90 days? Sorry.
After 90 days, they are discharged if they haven't found housing. Now, that's like every quote rule. If you are at 90 days and you've been doing a lot of stuff and you know, life has been kicking you down and we're on your side, of course, like we're going to help you. But we have to be clear. This is not a long-term situation. This is not a transitional housing program. You have 90 days to get yourself together and we need that space for the next people that are coming in. So it would be discharge. So if somebody is discharged after 90 days, they can return in a week and start that process again.
Do you have many people that do that?
We do. We do. And I would say that I don't think there is a high percentage of people that remain the full 90 days, but they do return. So they may stay 30, be gone for a couple, come back.
Earlier, you talked about the stress on your workers. And I know that when the transition house was closed down, that there was a lot of concern about how the workers were trained and the workplace situation. I'm wondering now, how serious is your concern and what's being done to address the needs of workers? I mean, when you're saying they're burned out, that's pretty serious.
I think it's serious. And that's why that number two of the strategic plan is one of my favorites. I mean, one of the reasons I'm here is that I believe if we create a very supportive and well-trained staff team, the clients will benefit by default. This is a very low-paying job. Our staff, we have implemented EAP programs recently in COVID, which is great. So we have access to, you know, ongoing 24-hour support, but we don't have the funds to be able to provide benefits or to pay even a living wage. So this puts us in a difficult position. So I think an understanding at a higher level at actually what is needed to provide support for this would have to come from a funding source, because we can only work with the funding we have. So one of my goals is to increase that, diversify our funding sources, and be able to offer staff benefits, increase their wages, and create a really great work environment for them to feel supported. Because no matter how educated you are or how trained you are, going in for more than 80 hours a week and dealing with what they deal with, there's no way you wouldn't get burned out as any type of human being, no matter how educated. So what I want to be able to have is excellent mental health supports for staff. So what we try and do now, as soon as you need a mental health day, you go, that's it. You, no questions asked. You don't have to worry about it, because we have to do that for each other and keep ourselves well. So we're trying to, with the resources we have, work together as a tight team and keep ourselves well. Whoever needs it gets it, and the others support.
I know that 69% of your budget comes from the county government, and the rest comes from fundraising. Is there a need to see government supply greater funds to your services? I mean, there's been a lot of talk about your need for money, but where is that money going to come from?
I believe that it should be coming from the government. It's very difficult to sort of understand where every dollar comes and all the streams they come from, but there are no real federal dollars coming to us. I think that would be helpful.
The Good Neighbor Coalition has raised concerns in the past, and you've moved out of the neighborhood, and I know that that's made a big change in that area. But at a recent Coburg Council meeting, Councillor Emily Chorley suggested that the residents' concerns have not been addressed by the municipality and that there continues to be concern about when you return. Can you bring us up to date on the relations between Transition House and its neighbors?
Well, I've been in this role since February, and because COVID hit a month later, that interaction that happened in the past was sort of something in the past. I haven't really had much interaction with the Good Neighbors. Now, I have read comments. I have been brought up to speed on their concerns. I understand they had a town hall last year and many concerns were raised. I think I'm probably sort of aligned with saying something like that seems like the not in my backyard syndrome. I don't know what to say because I am the type of person, the reason I do this type of work is because I believe every human being, no matter what, deserves opportunity to enjoy life. And I don't look at people who are struggling with addictions and mental health as people who've made the choice to go out and hurt others. I see them as needing human support. So it's very hard for me to respond to complaints that I don't see actual evidence of. So if somebody says, like I get calls all the time, like, I found beer bottles on my property. It's obviously your clients, clean it up. There are many people in this world who throw garbage away, who use drugs, use alcohol. I think as soon as the province was threatening to close the LCBO, we realized how many among us might need that. So they didn't. So I just can't respond to judgment. Now, if I have evidence of a specific situation, then I will handle it as the law defines. And that's the other thing I think is really important to understand, is that I am not an actual law enforcement officer. So if something happens outside of Transition House and it is assumed that it's one of our clients, it's the police who needs to be called, because I'm not their mother and I don't have any control over what anybody does in Coburg, you know, where they sit, what they do, who they fight. So I think that maybe a little bit more understanding of what the real situation is. Like, I've had reports, you know, I've heard gunshots. There's no gunshots. You know, I've had reports that, you know, are just, in my mind, until I see it, the evidence, I really can't respond to that. You know, and I'm going to stand behind the people who need that. They deserve that as human beings.
During the COVID, there has been a movement under Black Lives Matter that we defund police. And there's been a lot of talk about taking funds, either from the police or elsewhere, and starting to address mental health issues and addiction issues. And it's all stimulated an incredible debate around mental health and addictions and people who need social services. Do you have any sense of optimism that this debate, even though it's not directly about you and your services, could stimulate a greater interest in providing appropriate and full social services to those in need? And is COVID, while tragic and very negative. Is this a silver lining in a dark cloud?
That's a huge question. Now, in terms of where the funds go, whether it should be funding police or funding mental health, I'm not really sure, because I'm not sure how much the police are funded and how much they deal with mental health. I mean, we are dealing with the police and partnering with them on a regular basis because we do need them at times. I'm not sure I would say they need to or should be dealing with the mental health. I would say it's more like us engage with the people who know what they're doing. You know, people who are dealing in this type of field have specific training and understanding and knowledge that helps them to do that. So it is probably a good idea to have those people at the table. For me, what I'd like to see is the collaboration across ministries. So, for example, our clients are social service clients, and they may have access to the law, they may have access to the hospital, but each of those entities are all working independently and have their own rules that almost block the other. So, for example, I would look at the healthcare system. If somebody's struggling with addiction, they're not allowed to have healthcare. Not allowed to have healthcare related to their mental health. And to me, the first thing we need to do is all of us realize that if somebody has drugs in their system and they're schizophrenic, they're still schizophrenic, even though they chose to do that drug, and they still need help. And the longer we have those rules that if you did that drug, we can't help you, and kick them to the curb. So now the hospital's kicked you to the curb, and the police are going to come in because the other people don't want to see you around. So the police are going to come involved. Everyone's going to. So we're all doing our own thing. But in the end, the client's just bouncing in between, and no one's solving the issue. So if I have a person who needs a long-term care facility and they have an alcohol problem, they're not allowed to go to the long-term care facility. Like, so how do you say, so in the end, it means go sleep on the street.
Are there any smoke signals, though, that indicate to you that there might be a coming together of minds locally that we might start to address these things or not?
I'm always hopeful that that will happen. And I always think that through conversation, we all come to a better place. Communication, education, you know, it's all important. So I see, you know, some people call me an import because I moved here from Toronto a few years ago. So what I see here is something I've never seen before, really, in Northumberland County. I just see such an awesome place. I mean, these issues that we talked about are minor in terms of all the awesomeness that's happening. Like, just walking on the street, you see people who are interested to say hello. You have a lot of friendly people. You have a lot of activities to do, beauty in the county, and a lot of amazing people that go above and beyond. I do see opportunity for everything. What worries me in COVID is reactions based in fear and of the unknown. That's what I'm trying to do, is focus on the beauty of this and try and engage as many people as possible. And the county, Northumberland County, specifically Sarah Tanner, who has been leading all of this since the minute it happened. She's really been working. She's the one that will get no recognition, but has done everything to make this happen. She has made sure that every gap is addressed in this process and keeping us all on track. I do feel lucky to work with her, and I think with her continuing, we will get there. We will.
Ann Newman, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Oh, thank you.
That was my conversation with Ann Newman, Executive Director of Transition House. I want to thank both my guests this week for talking to me, and I want to thank all the listeners for tuning in today. Please join me again next week when we will talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life and Northumberland County. So please tune in. If you would like to listen or share this or any podcast, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. There you will find past podcasts, news, and other information about life and politics in Northumberland County. Or you can go to the radio station's website at northumberland897.ca. I'm Robert Washburn. Thanks for taking time out of your day to listen in, and I hope over the week you will continue to consider this. Thank you for listening to this podcast from Consider This. If you have any comments or would like to suggest a story, please contact me at considerthisnorthumberland@gmail.com, or you can message me on Facebook at Consider This. If you enjoyed this podcast or are looking for more news and information about Northumberland County, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. That's consider-this.ca. And don't forget to share. And again, thank you for listening, and stay tuned for more from Consider This.